I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition. Definition.
Let's face it, if it wasn't for the Industrial Revolution, you wouldn't be able to watch this video. Inventions like the spinning jenny and the power loom revolutionized textile production at the end of the 18th century. Technology advancement transcended across all industries, replacing workers who were manufacturing products by hand. The age of machines had begun. But like any other important chapter of human history, the Industrial Revolution has a lot of blood on its hands. It wasn't just the death of the cottage industry and artisans. What followed was the loss of morality, destruction in the name of creation, and a lot of messed up practices that would make you wonder, was the Industrial Revolution worth the bloodshed to make that iPhone 11 in your hand possible? Today, workplace safety is a major concern for almost every single industry. Every employee, no matter how risky the job, has the right to be safe at the workplace. But that wasn't always the case. Contrastingly, during the Industrial Revolution, a job in the factory meant wagering your life every single shift. People got killed or injured on a regular basis, and nobody gave a hoot about them. One might have a better chance at winning the pot at the London Derby than surviving a week in factories in London. Employers only cared enough to make sure the mess was cleaned as soon as possible and the factory carried on production at all cost. The victims were delivered to their family without any compassion or compensation. Deceased employees would be replaced the very moment or perhaps the next day, as there was no lack of hungry, desperate souls looking for jobs at that time. In fact, workers' death was more common than you could imagine. During the construction of the Panama Canal, 2 of every 5 workers died. The construction of the Transcontinental Railroad claimed 2 of every 25 workers' lives, while the Erie Canal's death claim stood at 1 out of 50. Working in factories was literally like playing hot potato with a bomb. All factories were equipped with boilers to generate steam that had no safety features. There wasn't even an off button to these giant pressure cookers, so they would explode all the time, sometimes taking the whole factory with them. By one estimate, during the late 19th century, there was an average of 1 boiler explosion every 4 days, and about 50,000 people a year died as a result. The factories in early industrial England were dependent on the lack of accountability so they could keep their profits high. Safety was way too expensive back then, and human resources were abundant, easily replaceable, and most important, dirt cheap. To be honest, a volatile and risky work environment doesn't seem so dangerous when one was living in a city with a couple of 100,000 people and their cholera-infested chamber pots. And for the industrialists, they had no care in the world for human life. As long as the public didn't start asking questions, they could just keep replacing the dead employees with live ones. They wouldn't even flinch before sending laborers down in coal mines with burning candles. Mining tunnels were cramped, prone to collapse, hot and dark. Electricity and battery-run equipment was still a distant dream, and the only way to navigate through these dangerous tunnels was to hold a burning torch or candle in hand. These explicitly dangerous depths were often filled with highly flammable natural gases. Unfortunately, a source of light like a torch or candle was not exactly the best option when trapped gases were extremely combustible and ready to explode if an open-source flame was provided. On May 25, 1812, 121 miners were inside the Felon Colliery Mine on the northeast coast of England when there was an explosion. 92 people died, including several boys as young as 8 and 9 years old. Many of the bodies were not recovered for more than a month because it was still too dangerous to go into the mine to look for them. The disaster inspired someone to think about inventing a non-flammable miner's lamp. What makes the whole thing more emotional is that the government and the media rarely cared about the plight of laborers in these factories. This apathy allowed industrialists to run their factories without ensuring any kind of safety protocol or humane environment for their workers. It also empowered industrialists to shift the blame of the high mortality rate in their workplace onto their workers. For instance, the Boston Herald blamed a screw factory worker named Michael Markham's overassurance of his capabilities when he was killed in a workplace accident while operating machinery. It was pretty common for the newspapers to blame the workers for carelessness and not taking their own safety seriously, when in fact there was no safety provided. The term American Dream may have been coined by James Truslow Adams in his 1931 book Epic of America, but the concept was prevalent back at the beginning of the 19th century as well. As the Industrial Revolution killed most of the cottage industries one by one, millions of rural people uprooted their entire families in hopes of seeking a better livelihood. They migrated to bigger cities so they could surrender their lives in servitude to the same machines that had replaced them. As the media industry had not entirely caught up with others' pace in the 19th century, the news was still carried by people in paper instead of radios, telegrams, or the internet. So the news wasn't exactly fresh when a man in a rural area heard of an employment opportunity in the city. By the time he'd reached the metropolitan area with his entire family, the opportunity would already be over. This would leave many new uprooted families lost in the city. Soon, cities were overcrowded with such desperate workers ready to work at any rate possible. Even though there were lots of new factories popping up everywhere, there were still not enough jobs to accommodate all unemployed migrants. People were eager to work, but the disparity between demand and supply of jobs created the opportunity for industrialists to hire labor below minimum wage. Laborers were treated as commodities, and once skilled craftsmen were now part of the mindless hives where fast, cheap, identical production superseded talented, unique, and expensive work. These factories were forced to work long, low-wage, terrible hours in dark and unsafe factories. To be honest, much has not changed over the years. Even though laborers have rights and safety today in the USA, they are losing the competition to South and Southeast Asian workers. They are still willing to work for dirt cheap wages due to lack of better alternatives. The 19th century saw a decline in mortality rates and a hike in life expectancy, despite the machines causing around 35,000 deaths and 500,000 injuries every year. However, procreating almost a full-strength soccer team was normal to Western parents. This, coupled with the growing problem of households lacking work due to the rise of the machines, caused the lower class to become poorer, as it got harder to raise multiple kids at once. With so many mouths to feed and low wages not helping the situation, parents needed more helping hands. Industrialization became the new challenge to childhood, replacing plagues and poxes. Children as young as 3 years old were employed to work in the harshest conditions because their parents told them to. Workdays were as long as 10 to 14 hours with nominal breaks during the shift. Factories would not make things easy for these kids as they were forced to work with dangerous machines snapping at their tiny fingers. Toxic fumes filled up their lungs, and they were often pushed to crawl under dangerous places to clean debris and dust. Such crevices were impossible for adults to squeeze into, but kids were qualified grease monkeys because of their miniature build. Additionally, as kids worked hard during daytime, there was no chance they would attend school. This created the vicious cycle of them getting trapped in factory working jobs because they had no other qualifications growing up. Fortunately, not everyone saw little kids as cheap labor. Jane Addams, the first American woman to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, was among the first to raise the issue of child labor after a few girls refused the candy she offered. Jane exposed the conditions of these candy factories and the workload the girls were subject to. Later, at the beginning of the 20th century, activists like Lewis Hine and Grace Abbott tried to improve the system from within. Though the battle was uphill, thanks to these heroes, today's kids get to spend hours digging in Minecraft instead of actual coal mines. Earlier, we mentioned the government had a very sorry stance about the labor affairs in the factories. Well, that was only half the truth. The entirety was far more horrific. When workers raised a concern of malpractices and abuse in the factories and demanded to be treated like human beings, the British government saw this as a dangerous trend. According to the British aristocracy, the mere thought of considering low-class workers as human beings was threatening to their power, and they considered it an act of rebellion. Fearing for their precious tea crumpets and croquet, they lobbied for the Combination Acts of 1799 and 1800. The acts made it illegal to form societies or clubs for the purpose of political reform. In simpler terms, they simply abolished the unionization of workers. This hampered any demand of laborers for a wage equal to their cost of living, and it widened the divide between the employers and the employees, plunging the low class lower. Moreover, this also hurt the Luddites. No, we're not talking about old people who are technologically impaired. Luddites were a group of British weavers who were understandably annoyed about being outdated by the invention of machines. They were trying to gain the government's notice of their plight by organizing, and when the government turned a blind eye, they protested the Industrial Revolution by committing vandalism at nearby factories. The destruction of heavy machinery did the job of seeking attention, but not in a positive manner. The government passed laws in 1812 to make the destruction of industrial machinery a capital crime. And it wasn't just an idle threat. In the latter part of that year, 14 Luddites were hanged for frame breaking. This caused the Luddite movement to die with them, along with weaving as a professional trade. Tell us in the comments if you would like us to cover more harsh realities that were normal during colonization times. And as always, thanks for watching Nutty History.
So I've been struggling lately. If you followed me for a while, you know this. About 9 months ago, I was gaining weight uncontrollably, covered in acne for the first time since I was 19, constantly exhausted no matter how much I slept or ate or exercised, and incredibly depressed and anxious despite being medicated. My GP did some blood work, said all my vitals were fine, and diagnosed me with obesity and told me to see a dietitian. But I knew that something was wrong, and I was terrified for my future. If I felt this awful at 30, what was I gonna feel like at 60? So I googled Hormone Doctor Minneapolis and found a functional medicine doctor who I, of course, had to pay for out of pocket because the US health insurance system is a topic for another day. And we ran some tests and found out I probably have PCOS, and my testosterone, estrogen, and cortisol levels were astronomically off the charts. And over the last 9 months, I've been dramatically altering my diet, increasing my intake of organic produce and animal products, increasing my muscle mass, and losing 20 pounds. And my energy levels are back to what they were when I was in college, and I'm probably in the best shape of my life. I've had the energy to launch a business and a course, which you should sign up for, link down below, and I feel truly like a new woman, okay? And this experience has led me to be more curious about what the hell I'm putting into my body. And while there are multiple factors that led to my health issues, not the least of which from the stress of the pandemic compounded by a truly awful big law job that caused me to lose my period and have weekly panic attacks, I've also seen so many people talking about our food system in the US and how it's slowly poisoning us. So I decided to do some snooping around and see for myself where this idea came from that the US food system is so much worse than other places. And in my research, I kept coming across the same thing: glyphosate. Glyphosate, glyphosate. What was this mysterious chemical, and why is it so much more prevalent in the US than in other similar countries? Well, strap in, bucko, because it turns out, once again, it has less to do with apples and bananas and everything to do with cold hard cash. My name is Leija, I'm a lawyer, and welcome to my new series, Follow the Money, where I unravel various happening in US law and history and discover how, in the end, it always comes down to cold hard cash. Roll the intro. Monsanto. You've heard of it. It was founded in 1901 as a chemical company producing food additives and later basic industrial chemicals. In World War II, the company assisted in the development of nuclear weapons. In 1944, it began manufacturing everyone's favorite insect repellent DDT, and in the 60s and 70s, it provided the US Army with Agent Orange as part of its herbicidal warfare program, leading to defoliation of 3.1 million hectares of Vietnamese forest, as well as disability, cancer, and birth defects in millions of Vietnamese and US soldiers who were exposed to the chemical. Then in the 80s, Monsanto stumbled upon the thing that it would become probably most widely known for, genetically modified crops. Specifically, crops that could withstand getting absolutely drenched with Monsanto's other favorite child, Roundup. See, they were having a hard time because in the 70s, they developed this handy-dandy herbicide called Roundup, meant to control weeds and plants, but the problem was that it was too good and could also kill the crops it was applied to. Bummer. Not so with GMO seeds. Now the seeds can withstand and absorb gallons and gallons of Roundup and thrive, while the weeds around it dwindle, allowing for easier crop growth and more productivity. Great. From there, Monsanto continued to grow, eventually being acquired by Bayer in 2018 for $66 billion, with a B. By the time of its acquisition, Monsanto was spending around $2.5 million per year on lobbying efforts alone, making it the biggest spender in the agricultural industry, which is notable because that is an industry known for lobbying. Much of its lobbying efforts have gone towards fighting the labeling of genetically modified foods, trying to keep the industry as opaque as possible for consumers. But its connections to Washington run much deeper than that, and those ties have allowed it to contribute to the degradation of our environment and our food quality here in the United States and, to a certain extent, globally. But let's focus on the US because I don't have time to make a documentary-length film. Specifically, I want to talk about Roundup and how the herbicide has come to absolutely dominate the agricultural industry in the US. As I've explained, Monsanto created genetically modified plants that could withstand high levels of Roundup. Because of this, in the 50 years since Roundup was developed, its use on crops and weeds in the US has ballooned. 90% of the corn, sugar, and soy grown in North America is genetically engineered. As a result, 85% of processed foods sold in the US, which are pumped full of corn, sugar, and soybean oil, contain GMOs. GMOs that have been drenched in Roundup. The key ingredient in Roundup is called glyphosate. Now, there's a lot of debate in the scientific community on the safety of glyphosate, and I'm no scientist, I'm but a lowly attorney, so I don't pretend to have the solution here in my silly little YouTube video, but let's just look at some facts. The EPA has determined that glyphosate is generally safe for human consumption. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, part of the World Health Organization, said it is probably carcinogenic. How did these two agencies come to such diametrically opposed conclusions? To find out, my friends, we have to follow the money. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, made its most recent determination that glyphosate is not carcinogenic in 2019, during the Trump administration. At the time, the EPA had been helmed for the previous 2 years by Scott Pruitt, former Attorney General of Oklahoma. On April 28, 2017, Pruitt fired scientists from the agency's 18-member Board of Scientific Counselors, indicating he intended to replace them with private industry representatives. In October 2017, Pruitt removed several scientists from EPA advisory panels and forbade any scientist who receives a grant from the EPA from then serving on those panels. By December 2017, 700 staff had left EPA during Pruitt's tenure, including over 200 scientists. During that same time, Pruitt had hired around 129 people, including 7 scientists. So, needless to say, the EPA was down a few scientists at this point. Pruitt's deputy administrator of the EPA was some dude named Andrew Wheeler, a former coal lobbyist. When Pruitt resigned from the EPA in July 2018 after 2 years of scandals related to his spending, conflicts of interest, and enriching himself and his family from his position, Andrew Wheeler, former coal lobbyist, became the acting director of the EPA, where he remained until the end of the Trump administration in January 2021. So we have an absolutely destabilized EPA rolling back tons of regulations, including declining to raise environmental standards for fine soot pollution, weakening mercury regulation, and declaring that glyphosate is probably not carcinogenic. Remember how Monsanto produces both Roundup, a glyphosate-based herbicide, and the genetically modified seeds that most growers use so that they can drench the crops in glyphosate and the crops won't die? Remember that? Well, Monsanto also contributed to Pruitt's Oklahoma election campaigns in 2010 and 2014 before he was eventually nominated by Trump to helm the EPA. But frankly, my friends, that is just the tip of the goddamn iceberg. Roundup has been been around for nearly 50 years. And for nearly 50 years, Monsanto has been in close cahoots with the US EPA to make sure that anytime questions arise as to the safety of glyphosate, studies will magically appear to refute the idea that it's unsafe. Throughout the 1970s, EPA staff repeatedly raised red flags about the inadequacy of testing data that Monsanto was submitting in support of glyphosate's original registration. For example, in an August 1978 memo, EPA scientist Christina Locke raised concerns about a Monsanto study in which the scientists from the contract lab had failed to record what happened in the experiment. A Monsanto scientist defended the study, saying, and I quote, "The scientific integrity of a study should not be doubted because of the inability to observe all primary recording of data." In other words, the EPA shouldn't concern itself with the absence of data, it should just trust the study's conclusions. The study that was paid for by Monsanto. The EPA scientists also pointed out that it is, quote, "difficult not to doubt the scientific integrity of a study when the lab stated that it took specimens from the uteri of male rabbits." Male rabbits do not have uteruses. Something is very wrong with this study. But the EPA is just supposed to accept it because Monsanto scientists say so. In fact, in 1985, the EPA labeled glyphosate as likely carcinogenic, specifically citing a mouse study from 1983 that supported the claim. The mouse study was conducted for Monsanto by a commercial lab called Biodynamics, but the results of the research were neither peer-reviewed nor made publicly available. Biodynamics studied 200 mice, 50 unexposed control mice, and three groups of 50 mice exposed to three different levels of doses of glyphosate. Four of the exposed mice, one at the middle dose and three at the highest dose, developed kidney tumors. In the fall of 1985, Monsanto recruited four outside pathologists to review the original tissue slides from the 1983 mouse study, and in a March 11, 1986 memo, they reported on the results of this review. One of the outside pathologists saw a tumor in the control group of mice, just like those found in the exposed groups. Based on this one finding, the EPA decided to discount the entire study on the grounds that if an unexposed control mouse had a tumor, the tumors in the exposed mice were not related to glyphosate. However, subsequent evaluation of the same evidence by other pathologists found no evidence of a tumor in the control mouse. But Monsanto had already achieved its goal of sowing seeds of doubt, pardon the pun, on the validity of that one mouse study. Throughout this process, the EPA was riddled with more internal dissent. In February 1985, EPA statistician Herbert Lacayo wrote an impassioned memo regarding the 1983 mouse study. He concluded that without glyphosate exposure, the odds of seeing the kidney tumors noted in the study were about 156 to 1. He said, and I quote, "Under such circumstances, a prudent person would reject the Monsanto assumption that glyphosate dosing has no effect on kidney tumor production. Our viewpoint is one of protecting the public health when we see suspicious data. It is not our job to protect registrants from false positives." But apparently, that's not what the higher-ups in the EPA thought. They decided to continue seeking outside experts until they got the answer they wanted. They brought in a scientific advisory panel. This 7-member panel included the head of biochemical toxicology and pathobiology at the Chemical Industry Institute of Toxicology. This institute was founded by chemical manufacturers and funded by organizations and companies that included the American Chemistry Council, an industry group that boasts Monsanto as a member, as well as pesticide manufacturers BASF, Bayer, and Dow Chemical. And the panel felt that calling glyphosate carcinogenic was going too far, and it suggested downgrading its classification to D, i.e. not classified. Then the EPA determined that this mouse study from 1983 wasn't sufficient, so a new one should be conducted. Probably a good idea. Monsanto, however, refused, pressuring the EPA to give up on the repeat study requirement, and the EPA backed down. According to a 2-year-long investigative report by In These Times, and I quote, "What is clear from available EPA internal records is that when test results suggest toxicity, EPA management, as opposed to EPA staff scientists, consistently gives Monsanto and its testing laboratories the benefit of the doubt. They defer to Monsanto's preferred conclusions instead of requiring the development development of additional evidence that would clarify the questions regarding glyphosate's carcinogenicity. The documents we examined indicate that the EPA may have asked for or intended to enforce a requirement for better data, but we have seen nothing to show that the agency ever did so. And then in 1991, the EPA announced it was downgrading glyphosate to a substance that shows evidence of non-carcinogenicity for humans. And after that, the glyphosate issue was pretty much put to rest for the next 25 years, allowing its use to grow pretty much unchecked in U.S. agriculture. That is until 2015, when the International Agency for Research on Cancer, part of the World Health Organization, released that report that I mentioned earlier, concluding that glyphosate is probably carcinogenic to humans. Monsanto, of course, immediately went on the defensive, including funding an entire toxicology journal issue devoted to articles funded by Monsanto asserting glyphosate's safety and casting doubt on contrary results, which seems to be a pattern for Monsanto. Just throw some money at it, write some journal articles based on faulty data, and generally muck it up enough to distract from the truth. According to the investigative report by In These Times, in its revisiting of glyphosate safety, the EPA has not commissioned or conducted any of its own studies to examine glyphosate's potential health effects. Rather, the EPA document relies on non-public industry research and industry finance reviews. It ignores the significant body of peer-reviewed literature, not only on the chemical's carcinogenic effects, but also on glyphosate's harmful effects on fetal development, hormonal balance, gut bacteria, and ecological balance. Additionally, neither the public nor the scientific community has access to the original study data from Monsanto upon which the EPA bases its claims of glyphosate safety. More recently, it was revealed that Jess Rowland, a former deputy director at the EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs during the Obama administration, colluded with Monsanto to kill a Department of Health and Human Services investigation into glyphosate, which was prompted by that International Agency for Research on Cancer report I mentioned earlier, which found in 2015 that glyphosate is probably carcinogenic. According to an email sent by Dan Jenkins, a Monsanto regulatory affairs manager, he had spoken to Jess Rowland, again the deputy director of the EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs, and she had told him, and I quote, "If I can kill this, I should get a medal." And why do we have access to the emails of the Monsanto regulatory affairs manager? Oh, because Monsanto has been sued over 100,000 times because of health problems linked to glyphosate. Monsanto has settled 100,000 Roundup lawsuits and paid out $11 billion as of May 2022, with 30,000 lawsuits still pending. In June 2022, the Ninth Circuit filed a decision in a Roundup case, and in the court's opinion, the Ninth Circuit urged the EPA to reconsider its conclusion that Roundup does not cause substantial harm to people or the environment. Also that same month, the Supreme Court dismissed an appeal by Bayer in another Roundup case. In July 2022, the 11th Circuit ruled that Bayer had failed to adequately warn about the risk of cancer from Roundup. And these are just a couple examples of many, many courts and juries finding that plaintiffs had evidence to show that they were harmed because of Roundup. And a lot of the science backs that up. A study from the University of Washington found that exposure to glyphosate increased an individual's risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma by 41%. The CDC recently released findings that up to 80% of Americans may have traces of Roundup in their urine, showing that they've been exposed to it. Considering that over 200 million pounds of Roundup are sprayed annually on U.S. crops, it's not surprising that most of the population has been exposed to it. But this isn't just in the U.S. Glyphosate is approved for use in the EU as well, though it is banned to some extent in many individual EU countries, including Belgium, the Czech Republic, Denmark, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Portugal, as well as in numerous towns and cities throughout Europe. And in Switzerland, supermarket chains Migros and Coop removed glyphosate-based products from their shelves due to health risks. And even though glyphosate technically isn't banned in the EU, the EU still places tougher restrictions on the amount of exposure to glyphosate, limiting it to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. In contrast, the US allows 1.75 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, though certain states like California and Minnesota have set stricter limitations. Because of the lax restrictions in the US and the prevalence of the use of GMOs in our foods, where many other countries have severely limited them, it means that glyphosate is in our food, it's fed to our livestock, it runs off into our water, and it even contaminates our breast milk. And of course, the people most exposed are farmers, a dwindling group who need support from the government in order to be able to move away from pesticide-riddled crops, the same government that's in bed with Monsanto. Farmers make up a large portion of the thousands of lawsuits against Monsanto, as many farmers were exposed to and continue to be exposed to Roundup directly on their skin, nearly daily, sometimes for decades. While Monsanto failed to warn them of any dangers and often resulting in cancer, disability, and death. And then there's also poor people who live in food deserts, or what some activists have rebranded as food apartheids, where access to organic, unprocessed food is nearly impossible, both because it doesn't exist, but even if it did, would be prohibitively expensive. But even if you're eating organic, it's in our water. 70% of American household drinking water is positive for above perceptible degrees of glyphosate. Urine testing shows glyphosate levels in US residents over 10 times higher than in Europe. Now, of course, exposure to Roundup and glyphosate doesn't account for all of our health issues here in America. I, again, do not have time for the full-length feature film it would take to unpack that. But doing this research does have me thinking twice about the additives in the food I'm eating.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Ymir Adis, and this is a Class War Battlefield podcast episode. It's so funny. For like the first month or so of my recording new episodes for this podcast, I kept just mixing up. Like, this is Ymir Adis, Ogaya, and this is, wait, no. I was out of practice. That's what I'm saying. Man, it feels good to be back. It really does feel good to be back, you know, second week of February. I've recorded a number of these. I can't wait to put them out for you. They discuss a lot of different things. And I even have some quote from the vault episodes that I'm looking into bringing out for you. So if it does indeed, if I do bring those out, I mean, I think I'm up to 5 or 6 episodes from the vault now that I haven't released that I'm like, yeah, these probably need to be released. So get ready for those. Anyway, you know, as always, PayPal me. And wait a minute, I did that at the beginning of the show, so I won't bore you guys with that. All right, so let's get into today's episode. A couple of months back, I found a book, a thick book, a book that I believe is over 1,000 pages. But the book is titled The Diseases of Occupations. It is by Donald Hunter. It is the 6th edition. And what the book does is what the title suggests. It lists hundreds of different diseases that one might sustain or gain, not technically not a gain because it's not a plus, right, from engaging in the occupational requirements of capitalism. It's the sixth edition, and this book is thick. If the pages were slimmer, the book could easily be 2,500 plus pages. And indeed, when I first pulled it off the shelf, I was like, oh, this has to be a 2,000 page book right here. But it wasn't. I was actually thinking of this book recently because obviously, you know, people have been talking about the country being in the midst of a mental health crisis. One of the episodes that is from the vault that I'm thinking about bringing out is when I recorded in 2001. I'm sorry, 2001. Wow, I wish. 2021. Before I actually went into work, there was a couple outside of my apartment fighting, and fighting rather loudly. And after it died down, I was thinking about that, and I recorded this episode to talk about the socioeconomic pressures that lead to loneliness and fights like that. It's that episode is rooted in the idea that there is a mental health crisis in the United States. And the reason, the primary reason there is a huge mental health crisis in the United States is capitalism. Is capitalism. When we think about depression. And depression has increased drastically, drastically in the last 30 years. When I was in high school, I remember there was a lot of talk of the high schoolers, and actually, I'm sorry, not when I was in high school, I was actually in middle school. When I was in middle school, there was a lot of talk of how that high school age group, this was in the mid-90s, was becoming one of the most heavily medicated group of children to ever exist in the United States. Now, to be fair, nobody was counting seriously the number of children that were medicated. So much as you could call it in the late 1800s, the number of children, and there are reports of this, so this isn't like, oh, you're crazy. No, there are reports of this. Children who were working in the mines and doing horrible jobs where, you know, their friends would lose body parts and things like that. These kids were smoking, they were drinking, they were taking things that today we'd be like, yeah, that's a drug. That's a drug. Just so they could get through it all. So nobody was counting that seriously. But in the modern post-World War II era, that group of young people were the most heavily medicated people in that time period. And when I was a young adult in my early 20s, I was 21, 22, I knew, I had a really good friend who had been on not only like ADHD medication, but medications that helped to regulate her mood since she was like 14. And if she missed a dose, so she was a few years older than me, if she missed a dose, she literally shook. She shook. Her body went into instant withdrawal. That's how much it had changed the chemicals of her body to the point where they needed it. I mean, she couldn't go a day without them. Now, I didn't know then, but I was getting a lesson. Because her and I used to talk, and she would talk about how crappy things were and how jobs were drying up. This was in the early 2000s. NAFTA had come to the town I grew up in and had ravaged it, and not only the town, but the county, drawing just dozens of companies, some of which had been there for 100 years, into being purchased by Wall Street people who didn't give two god, as my parents used to say, didn't give two goddamns about anybody or anything but the disease of making more money. And that's what it, you know, one of my elders told me that, and he's right. It's a disease. I look at it as a possession, because I've seen people ravaged by greed, and it's terrifying. It's terrifying. It's crack cocaine without the crack cocaine. Without the crack cocaine. But they pulled dozens of companies that kept that community, kept that county functioning, and moved them to Mexico, China, Taiwan, Thailand, all those places. And by the time she had entered the workforce, all of those companies which she had considered legitimate employment prospects, because she really didn't, you know, she wasn't trying to go to college and all that. She was just trying to work. All of those companies were quickly disappearing. And she moved prior to seeing what I saw. But by the time I left my community, you know, the one I grew up in 2013, all of the major employers were gone. Most of them, major employers in the county were gone. And the lone grocery store in the town I grew up in, which had been there for decades, closed its doors. That does not mean that there weren't jobs. There were, and still are. I still have family that live there. There are still jobs. Young people are still graduating. Young people are still finding jobs. However, and this cycle has been noted by people who I talk to still from the community. When people approach the age of 30, and they start seeing how dreary life is, they have a couple of recourses. Most of them are poor. So getting on the type of medication that they need to get on to stave off depression can be costly. Secondly, you know, most of them don't really want to be on medication like that when they don't feel like they need it. And truthfully, they don't. It's the environment that has them depressed. Or, and this is what most of them do, they just party their blues away. They just party. You know, parties are still happening. You know, folks who started partying in their teenage years are still partying in their 30s. Because as one of them put it to me, what else we gonna do? Cry about all this? Man, you know, we come together every couple of weeks. We have a grand old party. People get drunk. People get high. People, you know, sleep together and go back to their dreary lives afterwards. Which made me think of something, right? People often look at Rome and talk about how it descended into chaos and madness, and oh, they started having orgies and all of these feel-good things. But what they miss about the feel-good things is all of the not-feel-good things that were happening around those people. And everybody was powerless, particularly the wealthy, seemed absolutely powerless to stop the degeneracy of life. And I'm not talking about, oh, well, they shouldn't be having sex in groups. They shouldn't be taking, you know, drugs and stuff. I don't care about none of that. No. That is a reflection of a society that has stopped enabling people to naturally reach states of euphoria. And what I mean by that, and you see this in the United States, what I mean by that is when you feel a sense of accomplishment, you feel a state of euphoria. You feel a state of, okay, I'm kind of invincible here. When you feel accomplished, that's when you, and you don't, and your accomplishment is not threatened. That's when you are more likely to reach out to other people and say, I want you to feel like I'm feeling because I'm feeling so accomplished. I gotta help other people feel this way because this is great. But in order to accomplish, in order to make that happen, you cannot have a society that pushes this notion that everything has to be competitive in nature. Because accomplishments come at the expense of other people. Accomplishments come at the loss of other people. Oh, well, that's just how life goes. No, that's not how life goes. No, no, no. There are hundreds of studies that have proven that that's just not how people are. That's not the nature of people. The nature of people is cooperative. The nature of people is consensus. The nature of people is engaging with one another. I mean, think about this. Let's look at what happened in the United States in 2020. If the nature of people was solely competitive, why was it then that when people went to stores and bought out essential goods that other people needed, why is it then that oftentimes groups of people chided those individuals for being greedy? And those people, those small group of people who were like, yeah, but I got it all and now you can come and buy it from me for an inflated price. Those people looked at that chiding as just, oh, it's unimportant because competition. But the majority of people didn't act that way. See, the problem in this society is that capitalism in its ethics, greed, competitiveness, and many more, it's actually a minority position. It's actually a minority position. Now, I'm not talking minority like black, brown. No, I'm talking about there is a minority of the population that thinks and acts like that. And if you don't believe me, look at the quote investment structure that's at the heart of capitalism. The investment structure at the heart of capitalism turns the idea of majority-minority on its head when it comes to what those words actually mean. A majority stakeholder is a person who owns the most stock or has amassed the most stock in the hands of, quote, one person or one legal person. And that last part is important because an institution could be a legal person. It is not, as it should be, the people who hold as a block the most stock. Because that would never be, in many instances, that would not be the institutions and individuals who own 9% or 13%. You can be a majority stakeholder in capitalism by having 9%. of stock, or 13% of stock. The reason it's like that is because the people who have the deficiencies that enable them to constantly see somebody and something in a society as competitive, they're a minority group of people. But they make themselves out to be more than they are by indoctrinating others to think the way they do. The people who actually think the way that capitalism requires you to think, they're probably about 15% of the population, particularly of white populations. But their enablers probably number 30 or 40% of the population, because they get something from it. And not only do they get something from it, but they're true believers. In some cases, they just get something from it. So they're, you know. But I digress. When we talk about the mental crises in this country, we do not talk about the problem. And this doesn't fit with everybody. Chris Hedges obviously wrote a book on this. I've seen other books too, and for some reason I'm coming up blank on them, though I haven't read those ones. The Chris Hedges one is that was one of the most depressing books I ever listened to. I listened to it while I was at work, and it just depressed the hell out of me. But it was true. It was all true. And a lot of the writings he's done since on Shearpost is... they're true. I mean, it's unarguably, they're true. But we don't talk about them being true. We don't. And this is a failure of not media, but the average person to accept what their life really is like and to try to ameliorate the suffering in it. My niece's generation, many of which were born after the millennium, the old way of calculating the millennials had the millennials being born roughly in 1980, starting in 1980, and going to roughly 2005. So my niece would have technically been a late millennial. They've adjusted that figure, they've adjusted those years several times to now that it's like 1982 to 1996 or something like that, which is insane. There's no generation that's 14 years. There's no generation that is 14 years. Now, maybe from the standpoint of corporations, there's a generation that's 14 years because there was significant media change in 95, 96, 97, but there is no generation that is 14 years. So I typically go to the old numbers. I go 1980 to 2005 because, you know, those are more realistic. A generation 20 to 30 years, I split it in the middle, 25. But so with her generation, which technically that wouldn't be her generation, it would be the generation after hers. People born in 2005, though, they don't seem concerned. See, back in the 1990s, that generation, that late generation X, when they were coming into maturity in the 90s, they were afraid, just like my generation was afraid, to criticize capitalism because our parents were doing decent. And when we did try to criticize capitalism, our parents would simply say, you have nothing to complain about, things are so good, shut up. And this was always, you know, this was the early 1990s. By the mid to late, you know, by the mid-90s, it was still the same thing. Oh, you know, you're still good, shut up. But by the late 90s, less people were saying that.
Less people were saying it. And, but we were ingrained to not want to criticize capitalism because, oh, well, you have nothing to complain about. Capitalism's been good to you. Shut up. This newer generation, born in 2006 and above, they don't care. Because as one of them put it, and I have to include the early 2000s also in this. As one of them put it to me, what are they going to do to us? They've taken the jobs. They've got us living, many of us, like nomads. They've taken our homes. Sounds like a Bruce Springsteen song, which it is. Bruce Springsteen put out this great album that so many people did not listen to called Wrecking Ball. Oh, it is such a good album. Oh, right in the heels. He released it on the heels of the 2008 financial crash. It is just a phenomenal piece of work. Oh, that album is one of my all-time favorites. So they've taken our homes, you know, they got us living like nomads and all that. So, yeah, screw them. They don't care about us, so why should we care about them? And that's really this generation's perspective of it. Because Wall Street has gotten out of hand. The wealthy have gotten out of hand. They don't respect anything but what we can make money off of. And so, I understand. And I applaud them for that. At the same time, they now are the most medicated generation in the history of counting that type of thing. They're the most medicated. And that was starting to show up in the 2010s. No, I'm sorry, in the early 2000s. It became more noticeable in the 2010s, and now it's just what it is. And let's be fair. Let's really talk about this as it should be talked about. The reason these kids are on a lot of drugs, and some of them pharmaceutical, and some of them not so much. The reason why opioids took off is because from an economic standpoint, not only is it profitable, which, hey, you're supposed to make profit any way you can, morals be damned. Oh, well, that's not true. The history of capitalism says, yes, it's true. Capitalism has no morals, just like a corporation has no morals. It's a psychopath. So, yeah, morals be damned. But also, capitalism depresses the soul. Oh, man. I've mentioned this before. There's a... In the future, you know, with your support and your help, I want to be able to start producing more of these. But I also have the idea for another podcast that's going to take some time. It'll take me probably 6 to 8 hours worth of research each week on top of a number of hours to actually prepare the thing, at least in the beginning. And I'm going to talk about words, among other things, in that podcast. And recently, I was looking at the word depression, which is a... whose core word is depress. D-E-P-R-E-S-S. And when you see, especially in the older dictionaries, what depress means, and then you think about the idea of depression, it's staggering. Capitalism seeks to kill the soul, just like it's killing Mother Nature. No, it's not really killing Mother Nature. It is doing harm and injury to Mother Nature, and Mother Nature is about to show it who's boss, which is very concerning to me. because when Mother Nature starts to show people who's boss, people start to starve and die and stuff like that. Anyway, just as it's doing harm to Mother Nature, it's doing harm to the human psyche. It's doing harm to the human form. It's doing harm to the human soul. It's doing harm to all of those things that make a being whole. I was surprised, by the way, to learn something. I was doing some research, again, on words, and I learned that the word individual comes from the word indivisible. Now, here's the thing. One of the chief bugaboos that I have with the English language is that it is not consistent. And of course it wouldn't be. English is an imperium language. It is cobbled together through necessity from, colonizers who were trying to unify the places they colonized. And they did so by, tying this language together with other languages and throwing out what they couldn't use. So when I learned, and by the way, I've thought that for a long time, but when I learned that the word that individual, I-N-D-I-V-I-D-U-A-L, had sprung from was indivisible, I was like, wait, what? That's not even, no way. Especially how people use it, the individual. They don't use it like indivisible. They don't. So that's when I started conceiving, okay, there's something deeper with this word that we're not actually seeing. And I've done some work on that. But from the standpoint of the being, and West Asia, Europe is actually called West Asia, by the way, continent as whole. Anyway, they don't do spirituality well, especially the people who aren't the indigenous there. So they don't really have a good concept of what the being is. Now, I like to think of the Kemetic or Egyptian concept of the being as the most practical and likely. And that means you have multiple pieces within your being that make your being whole. Among them is the soul and what we often think of as the personality. When you agitate the being enough, you can pull those two apart. Or when you inspire the being, you allow it to flourish. You allow it to prosper. You pull them two together. And the self becomes subjective to the soul. I've known for a long time that when we talked about depression, I've known this since 2006 at least. When we talk about depression, we are talking about something that is happening to the soul, a pressing down onto the soul. The soul is not able to properly communicate with its environment because it is being pressed down upon, needlessly and unnaturally, which is causing a person to feel empty. It's causing them to feel detached. It's causing them to feel dejected. It's causing them to feel withdrawn. I've known that for a long time. When looking at the individual, I realized that part of the depressing process is moving the personality further away from the soul, giving the soul less input on the external environment. Now, you may think, this is crazy, this is nuts, this is da-da-da-da-da, but all I'm really doing is restating and reorienting some of the modern ideas of the psyche. That's all I'm doing. That's all I'm doing. People are suffering. People are suffering from the inability to reach their potential. But not just the inability to reach their potential. Because, see, that's happened for millennia, especially in European societies. That's happened for millennia. The problem isn't just that they aren't reaching their potential. The problem is, historically, they know that there was a time period that they could reach their potential. And that time period wasn't 200, 300, 500 years ago. That time period was 50 years ago. And the people who are forcing them into positions wherein they cannot reach their potential are the same people who were given the advantages 50, 60, 70 years ago to reach their potential. And now that they have reached their potential, they are using the positions that they have gained not to reproduce the same circumstances that gave them that leg up, but to deny access to that leg up to the coming generation, into the to this generation, into my generation. They are so hyperly competitive and diseased by greed that they are willing to prevent, the society from being regenerative. Which if a society is not regenerative, it dies. They want to prevent it from being regenerative in the thinking, in their thinking. They're thinking about their prodigies and, oh, well, I need to keep my prodigy in their position so they can do what I've done. What did you do? You were given the greatest head start of any generation. Any generation that has existed on this planet, you were given the greatest head start. And now you seek to deprive that head start from other people. Bill Gates, greatest head start of any generation. You didn't make yourself. Elon Musk, greatest generation, greatest head start of any generation. You didn't make yourself. The government helped you. We know the stories. All of these rich people, including the Kochs, who like to talk a lot of trash about, oh, you know, I'm libertarian. I hate the government. The government needs to get, please. The government helped you along the way. You know it. I know it. Everybody knows it. But it don't matter. These young people know that they are being deprived by a generation who themselves were not deprived. And that's what makes their emotions even more turbulent. Because what they understand is that they are being repressed not by a system, but by individuals, by people who have decided that they are going to take certain measures against them. Now, mind you, my definition of system involves networks of people engaged in action with determination and yada, 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 right? My definition includes that. But most people don't think in terms of that. Which, that is really what blows a lot of people's minds. When they start thinking in terms of the individual and how individuals network together to keep a reality in place that no longer suits the day and time. Now, I want to press on here because I want to talk about one more thing that's kind of attached to all this. One of the things that I love to do, this is like one of my favorite pastimes. It's a not really a guilty pleasure because it's just not. I love to look at old books. I've told y'all this before. I'm a big fan of, now when I say old books, I'm not necessarily talking about like 1600 years ago. I mean, some of those books are pretty cool too. I mean, especially the scrolled ones, because they used to take some really beautiful imagery and like draw them all over the place. That part's gorgeous. I'll give you that. But no, I'm talking about books from the 1700s, the 1800s, the early 1900s, in a few cases the 1600s. Even though I gotta acknowledge the 1600 ones are a little bit weirder. I mean, some of them aren't, but there's a lot of different punctuations. Letters don't always look the same. It's interesting. It really is interesting, and it gets even more so when you start reading or trying to read other languages, like the Germanic language. It's interesting. Or French. It's interesting. So much ambiguity in those time periods when it came to language. They were still trying to sort it all out. I will say, though, I missed the dramatic punctuation in English because it used to actually tell a story along with what you were writing. Anyway, in those time periods, to write a multiple volume set of books to really deep dive into something was no big thing. People did it all the time. But today, we don't do that. Today, we don't do that. And the question is, why? I'm not going to answer that. I just really want to know why. Like, a lot of people went crazy for Bianchi's Capital. Oh, man, it was, you know, it's a dynamo of great information and all this other stuff. And yes, I mean, he wrote a great book on that one. But for Christ's sake, we haven't had an update of Das Kapital, so far as I could tell, since it was written. Why not? Capitalism has changed so much. Marxism has parsed out so much more about capitalism. Why is there not a 3 or 4 volume refiguring of what capitalism is? Even if you don't want to take a Marxian standpoint, why isn't there? And I'm not talking about these academic tomes that are $300 that's never going to actually help anybody. Das Kapital is great because it's accessible by all people. Why is there not that drive to produce these multi-volume sets that are available to everyday people? I mean, it's if we were going to, let's say, a group of 10 scholars, hopefully critical of capitalism. Yeah, and by the way, you know, don't at me about, oh, well, you know, of course you're going to be critical of it and yada, 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 and, you know, you have to be balanced. No, I don't. I don't understand this, because I've had this discussion recently with people. Understand this. I'm not balanced when it comes to cancer in a healthy body. Cancer and a healthy body. When you're talking about something that is carcinogen and it could cause cancer and a healthy body, to be balanced means to put that carcinogen into the body and say, well, we'll see what happens. That's balance. I'm not about that. I'm not about that. I don't give two god darns about cancer. I don't. No, I'm not going to be balanced and allow cancer to ravage a life. No. And capitalism is a cancer. It is proving itself over and over and over and over again to be a cancer. It is destroying everything it touches. And it's destroying it by sucking out the vitality, which is what cancer cells do. It hollows out people like cancers. cancer cells go, they take over a cell, hollow it out. Then it becomes a cancer cell and starts to read the regenerative process all over again. Capitalism has proven itself to be that. So I'm not going to act like it hasn't. Now, people are always like, well, it's done some good stuff. Yes, and sometimes when you have cancer, it actually gives you psychic powers. Other times, it makes you angrier. Sometimes, it stables out your hormones while also poisoning the whole area. Cancer can do some stuff that's quite remarkable, but it's still cancer. I digress. Let's say 10 scholars got together and wanted to write a definitive book on a multi-volume set on capitalism. Why has that not happened? I'm not talking a fake multi-volume set either. I'm not talking, oh, well, each volume's going to be 200 pages and there's going to be 12 of them. Okay, it's 2,400 pages. Technically, I guess you could split that up into three volumes and boom. But come on. You're going to tackle capitalism, the history of it, you know, rooting it in feudalism, mercantilism, imperialism, colonialism. You're going to tackle capitalism as a political economic system in 2,400 pages? Even Marx wasn't that crazy. And by the way, I missed one stage of it. The roots of capitalism is in predominantly Rome, and I mean, granted, there's other areas that it touches too, but the corporation concept comes from Rome. How does that work? Some of the economic elements from Rome, from how it managed the its empire, all of that has been carried over into capitalism. My point is this, ladies and gentlemen. I've made this statement before. We have, I think, entered a period of time where academia is going to have to really shift what it does. We don't need books typically written by one person. There's an elder that I work with frequently, and it's amazing to think about some of the lessons I've learned working with him. He has given me perspectives on works that are legendary, written works that are legendary in the black community, particularly historical works. And that perspective is rooted in the idea of groups of people sharing ideas, groups of people having a central focus and purpose for what they're writing. And when I think about a lot of books that have been written in the last 20 years, most of those books are going to be forgotten in the next 15. And that's not to spit on academics or academia. Most of them just, they're flashes in the pan in the moment. There's good books also, and Lord knows, as a person who collects and likes to read books from the 80s, from the 70s, from the 60s, from the 50s. I could tell you, there's amazing books that have been written. Ironically, most of those books were good during their time, or at least among a small group of elite people who understood the significance of those books. We need multi-volume works on capital to really explore what it is and how it operates and how it's evolved over the last, you know, number of centuries. We are going to need multi-volume works on colonialism and imperialism, and not only what it is, but the dynamics of it, how it has been utilized to conquer people spiritually, emotionally, mentally. Look, from the standpoint of history, we now have access to some of the greatest medical revelations ever. We know about syndromes and diseases and, you know, afflictions that we just, and illnesses that we just, you know, they were unimaginable 100, 200 years ago. But most of those things, unlike in the book that I mentioned at the beginning, are not put into the context of how have they been emphasized, how have they been implanted, how have they been aggravated by the social political atmosphere created by capital and capitalism and colonialism and imperialism. Think about this. Think about this. Think about this. There is an obscure branch of history called psychohistory. You can look it up and see what it means. Think about this, though. What if there is a multi-volume set written on the looking from the standpoint of modern medicine, modern revelations, when it comes to the psyche, psychoses, all of that? What if there was a multi-volume set written on American history and how these syndromes and diseases and illnesses impacted the people who impacted history? Now look, that's a very thin concept. It may not be, it would have to be fleshed out more, but think about what could be learned from that. What could be learned from that? Moreover, we are in the, you know, we're in the midst of a ecological crisis. Quick shout out to Michael Perlman in his book Invention of Capitalism. Michael Perlman, P-E-R-E-L-M-A-N, Invention of Capitalism. Very powerful book. He talks about, in that book, the ecological costs of capital's need to create profit from agriculture. In driving towards that profitability, capital, the invisible hand, no, rich people, and sometimes greedy farmers, decreased the diversity, and I would probably say versity, of agricultured plants significantly, because some plants weren't as hardy, so you couldn't store them as long. Some plants were harder to grow in mass bunches. They needed other plants around them to communicate with, or else they wouldn't grow that well. And other plants were deemed to be too much work to cultivate en masse. They decreased the biodiversity significantly in the 1800s. In pursuit of agriculture profitability. And no, let me say that again. Massive agriculture profitability. How is there not, and look, that's something that I haven't looked at significantly, and I might reach out to Michael Perlman and see if he can help me with some works on that, because that's actually quite stunning of not necessarily an idea, but a bit of information. I mean, it really goes hand in hand with what we're going through today. But how has there not been a multi-volume set written on that? More with the Invention of Capitalism, a brilliant book. The Invention of Capitalism suggests that there needs to be a multi-volume legal history of the development of capitalism. And maybe, you know, there's probably one of them sitting somewhere, you know, like not necessarily a legal history, but, you know, the laws of capitalism. Because it didn't happen in one foul swoop. There was work that had to go into it. And laws had to be changed. Customs that had been around for 1,100, 1,200, 1,500 years had to be done away with. I mean, there is so many topics that need to be written into multi-volume sets that it blows my mind that this has not happened yet. And even the crazy thing is, all of these things that I'm talking about could actually go into one set, multi-volume set, dissecting capitalism. Then again, imagine, in today's modern world, somebody actually taking the time with a group of people to write such a multi-volume work. Maybe it will happen. I mean, it would probably be an expensive work. A couple of million dollars might have to go into it. And unless it is written in an accessible way, you know, it could lose a lot of money. But if it's written like Das Kapital, and, you know, as brazenly clear as Das Kapital sometimes is, you know, it could work. It could work. To say nothing about the multi-volume works that are needed on, you know, explaining the indigenous origins of socialist concepts. Yeah, there's a lot. So thank you very much for joining me today. This one was a little bit longer than I had thought it would be. In fact, it's funny. So quickly, before I let you go here, just really quickly, something personal. Prior to starting to record this again, you know, back in 2021, 2020, there were times where I struggled to get to 40 minutes. And there were times where 40 minutes flowed out of me like water. Recently, I'm not really caught up in the time much anymore, but that's when I've recorded these very long versions where I'm like, oh, okay then. So thank you guys for being here with me today. If you can, please support the work I am doing. Cash App me, CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. That's Cash App. CWB Podcast. You can also hit me at PayPal. I'm not sure if that one's working yet, so you try it and it doesn't work, please let me know. CWB Podcast on PayPal. CWB Podcast on PayPal. I am your brother, Brian Meredith. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun.